Welcome to Reboot Republic, the podcast that goes behind the headlines and looks at the big issues in this republic of inequality. We are the podcast of solutions and the podcast of hope, and I'm your host, Rory Hearn, and I'm absolutely delighted to be joined today by Orla Kelleher, who is an Irish Research Council postgraduate scholar doing her PhD, coming to a close, in the Sutherland School of Law in UCD, and her area is climate change, climate law and climate rights and environmental justice. Orla, I'm delighted for you to be here on Reboot Republic today.
Thank you very much for having me, Rory.
Orla, yeah, no, it's really great. And climate is something we have touched on here before and talked about the climate emergency and crisis, and particularly from a environmental justice perspective and social justice perspective and inequality. Just in terms, I suppose, listeners would be, you know, I think thinking about and climate change, I suppose, like many other issues, you know, to a certain extent has been, you know, understandably, you know, gone to the, you know, below COVID in terms of the public debate and public discussion. But now as we're entering, hopefully, more of a post-COVID context, climate change is obviously, along with, you know, housing and health, is you know, the key issue that we need to address as a society, as a country. And, you know, people, I think their minds will kind of gone to climate over the last couple of weeks where we've seen such extreme hot weather. Do you think from, you know, in terms of, was that linked to climate change? You know, there's been some discussion about that. What's your own thoughts on that?
Yeah, so I think in terms of kind of attributing recent events to climate change, there's definitely, there's a whole wealth of science that sort of looks at whether or not we can attribute extreme weather events to climate change. And as probably some of the best science around it is in terms of being able to link it, is around heat waves. So there's definitely a wealth of science that would say that the heat waves we're experiencing today are made significantly more likely by climate change. So I think there's little doubt that these events, if they're not directly attributable to climate change, are definitely, we're kind of loading the dice or kind of stacking the odds against ourselves that these events will become more likely going forward. Yeah,
and in terms of then your own work, to explain a little bit, because you have a legal background and that's your kind of your area. How does that kind of link in with, or maybe you could explain for listeners that kind of legal dimension, which is getting increasing kind of, I suppose, interest and involvement in climate change and the whole discussions around that and policy and research?
Yeah, so in terms of my own research, I'm interested in an area called climate litigation. So climate litigation has sort of emerged over the last number of years, and it's been a real surge in it since 2015, really, since the Paris Agreement. And what it's arisen out of in a lot of circumstances is individuals and NGOs being particularly frustrated with the lack of political progress on climate action. And in response, often out of desperation, they've turned to courts to try find legal answers, to try unblock political deadlock, to try kind of hold key actors, be it states or fossil fuel companies at times, accountable for contributing to climate change. So you might remember in the last 12 months, there was a big Irish climate case. Where Friends of the Irish Environment successfully held our own government to account in terms of producing a climate mitigation plan that wasn't actually going to mitigate climate change at all, but actually allow emissions to continue to rise. So I'm particularly interested in what I would describe as systemic climate cases, where individuals kind of take a whole of system approach to challenging I focus on states' responses to climate, and particularly where they use human rights as a tool to try and do that. And we're increasingly seeing that those kinds of cases are actually managing to have some kind of impact. So in an Irish context, I would hazard that a lot of the major developments in kind of climate law and policy were at least in part as a consequence of that kind of brilliant campaign and case. Equally, in Germany, a similar case kind of where German children actually took a case against their government and went to their constitutional court and successfully managed to get the German government to increase its emission reduction targets. So in the week after that German case, the German government announced that it was going to significantly increase its emission reduction targets. So they have this potential that I'm kind of curious about, and I'm really interested in sort of figuring out how legal systems respond to these really disruptive cases.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think it's, you know, something that, you know, you're looking at is that idea of the right to the environment, which is an interesting concept in human rights, that linking that environment and do you bring in social justice there as well, perspectives, or, you know, how you can explain a little bit on that?
Absolutely. So I think that's something I'm absolutely fascinated by, is this kind of idea of a right to a healthy environment and what it sort of means in this context. So firstly, in a lot of countries around the world, they have a constitutionally recognised right to some kind of healthy environment, sometimes a safe climate, sometimes it might take the form of kind of rights of future generations, and how that can kind of impact or limit what governments can do in terms of you know, how they balance kind of the interests of present generations against future generations. In that Irish climate case, interestingly, that idea of a right to a healthy environment had been recognised as an unwritten right previously in the Irish Constitution, which meant that even though it's not written into the Irish Constitution, a previous High Court had suggested that it could be read into the Constitution, that it was so important for the enjoyment of all other rights that it made sense that we would also have this right to a healthy environment. Ultimately, the Irish Supreme Court determined that it was either superfluous or too vague at this stage to read it into the Constitution, but did give some indication that it may subsequently find its way into the Constitution via, for example, a referendum around the issue. So there's a really interesting campaign just taking off at the minute around whether or not it's, you know, it's time for the government to call a citizens' assembly that might consider these kinds of issues. I'm very interested in how these rights interact, you know, with other civil and political rights as well as socioeconomic rights. So, for example, the right to life, the right to health, right to, in an Irish context, bodily integrity, the right property rights. Like, all of these rights are potentially at play when it comes to climate change. So, you know, it's a very interesting space to figure out whether or not we can actually find proper human rights violations for example, not doing enough to tackle climate change. And these cases are very live at the minute. There's a group of young people, actually there's three cases, but one particular group of young people from Portugal are taking, they're taking 33 governments to court to the European Court of Human Rights, saying that they've not done enough to protect their rights in the context of climate change. So it's definitely a fast moving space. Yeah.
And obviously going to, I think, become increasingly, you know, as you said, that way of holding governments to account. And I suppose on that, when we look at governments and what they're doing at an international level, you know, we have, you know, the Paris Agreement and, you know, the criticisms of that. And now we've, you know, there's another conference going, another COP26 going to be held in November this year in Glasgow, where governments are going to come together and, you know, make another agreement. Do you think that governments are doing enough internationally, or what's your assessment of the international level at which we're responding to the climate crisis?
And kind of a very simple answer, governments, especially developed country governments, and as part of that, Ireland, are definitely not doing enough to tackle the climate crisis. So I suppose what happens in climate change, what makes it so sort of intractable in lots of ways, is that those who have contributed the most to the problem, those who are best able to pay for the for responding to climate change, those who have sort of benefited historically from emissions are the ones who are also sort of best protected and best insulated against the impacts. So it's estimated that the global south will bear about 75 to 80% of the burden of climate impacts. So those will be disproportionately felt by developing countries when they have contributed the least to climate change. So in terms of what countries have done to date, for example, we started reducing emissions back in about 2000, we would have only had to reduce our emissions year on year by about 1 or 2%. It would have been very manageable. It would have been, you know, wouldn't have made a huge impact in terms of sort of the scale of action required. But because particularly developed countries have, rather than, you know, reducing their emissions, allowed them to grow exponentially, the kind of scale of the challenge now is enormous. Like, you read IPCC, which is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the expert scientific body, their calls are becoming all the more kind of dramatic, and you don't tend to hear very dramatic language from scientists.
Yeah.
You know, tend to be quite measured in their approach, but they're calling for transformative change, for substantial and sustained emission reduction. So, you know, the language we start to hear from scientists is increasingly grave, and the response has for the last number of years been business as usual by developed country governments, and Ireland being no exception to that. In terms of what we have done to date, under the Paris Agreement, countries agreed to a target of limiting global warming to well below 2 degrees Celsius and pursuing efforts to stay below 1.5. In terms of the impacts that we will feel at 2 degrees Celsius or 1.5 degrees Celsius, they're still enormous. Even if we were to manage to limit warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius, which at this point is sort of our best case scenario, we would still, millions of people will still suffer the impacts of heat waves. Millions of people will suffer from food scarcity, from water scarcity. You know, so it has really real tangible impacts. And there's often a perception in developed countries, Ireland in particular, I would say, that this is not really going to affect us, that this is an issue for developing countries, and that somehow we'll be insulated. But the level of displacement that's likely to cause within our world, where, you know, areas will become uninhabitable, you know, means that this is absolutely a global crisis, and one that will ultimately come to affect us too. Often within developed countries, there's been a sort of a techno-optimism. So within whatever targets we're going to take on, we kind of assume that at some point in the future, we'll have technologies available that will allow us to suck in carbon, and that we will be able to rely on these negative emissions technologies to sort of bail us out of the crisis we're kind of bringing ourselves towards. And I suppose what the really difficult part of that is how that has sort of just become part of the norm, the assumption that that's what we're going to do. And so, for example, even within our own recent climate act here, that has been explicitly incorporated within the act, that there is an assumption that in reaching our 2050 target, which for a country like Ireland is just far too late to be decarbonising, that a big element of that will encompass negative emissions technology. So, I mean, the scientists are very clear that negative emissions technology is subject to huge feasibility and sustainability constraints. We don't know what kind of adverse repercussions we could have from that. And so really what should be happening at this point is sustained and really substantial emission reduction. So we're not really at the races at all in terms of what we're proposing. In the Irish context, as part of the programme for government, we saw that the Green Party, along with Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil, agreed to a 51% reduction in emissions relative to by 2030 relative to 2018 levels. So that 2018 levels is kind of, it's a bit, in my view, a little bit sneaky, because the baseline year should be 1990, which is the year that we agreed to tackle climate change at a global level. And so I think that decision to land on 2018, ultimately, when you sort of translate that into the 1990 levels, it only works out as a 46% reduction approximately relative to 1990 levels. So if we kind of stack that up compared to other countries, it's just not, it's not ambitious at all, really. You know, for example, I mentioned Germany. Germany has committed to a 60% reduction by 1990 levels by 2030. Other countries like Denmark have committed to a 70% reduction. So this idea in Ireland, we have been laggards for years, but this idea that we are committing to such low targets, really, we're kind of storing up a very dangerous future for young people, for children, for future generations, when we're not taking the climate crisis seriously.
It's a really interesting analysis, and those figures there are fascinating, because you know, you hear some of them been thrown around, and you know, it's hard to get your head around them. But that idea, you know, that you're putting across there, that you know, we should really be looking at the 1990 targets, you know, and working back from there rather than 2018. When you think about it, it makes sense, because as you say, at that point we were in a climate crisis, and surely we should be getting emissions back below what they were. I said, using that as the baseline, if we're actually going to try and get to, you know, some way to really tackle the climate crisis and what's ahead. Do you think that, because a lot of the presentation in the media of the climate bill and a lot of the talk has been, you know, this was a dramatic bill and this was, you know, really groundbreaking, and Ireland is, you know, you'll read the Irish Times, but Ireland's a leader in this. And yet what you're saying there is, well, that's not actually the case, you know. Why is this analysis missing in the media discussion of this?
That's a great question. I think, I mean, it's depending on the sort of the perspective you take. Ireland has basically kind of dragged its feet for years on climate. So I suppose we're kind of starting as, you know, at the very back of the line, if you want. And so we do have to increase our ambition radically. But this idea that we're going to, you know, increase our ambition radically by becoming the second worst in the class or the third worst in the class, to me, doesn't really cut the mustard. You know, it's just, it's not enough, quite simply. And the impacts of that are so real. And so, you know, they're almost existential in terms of their impact, that I find it very difficult to sort of fathom that, you know, how little kind of regard there is to what's going to, what the repercussions of not doing this are. So, you know, Ireland will, and it's well documented, suffer impacts of climate change. Coastal flooding will become more common, and you know, impacts of heat waves, you know, there will be increased mortality rates from that. Issues around, you know, in over the last number of years, we've seen the migration crisis in the Mediterranean, which was absolutely heartbreaking to watch. But that's only, you know, kind of the tip of the iceberg in terms of what we can expect from the impacts of climate change. The idea that we're not taking it seriously, I mean, it sort of beggars belief in lots of ways. Additionally, this sort of short-termist view doesn't make that much sense to me, in that at a European level, kind of alongside Ireland negotiating its own climate bill at home, in Europe, developments are happening very quickly. And at the European level, it's been agreed now that the EU will reduce its emissions by at least 55% by 2030. So it's actually potentially going to be a lot more ambitious at the EU level, what's going to be required of Ireland. So this idea that within our own climate bill that we've locked ourselves into something a lot less ambitious, to me, is, you know, it's so short-termist, because ultimately we are going to have to increase our ambition significantly. And if we don't, you know, the impacts are potentially irreversible. So it is very, very serious. But I suppose I feel like a lot of this is all very grave sounding, and maybe what I'd like to emphasize is that the solutions to tackling climate change can really improve people's quality of life. You know, the kind of, I suppose, the positive elements of decarbonizing are, you know, improved air quality, better quality of life, warmer houses, and, you know, really good transport networks that we're not all sitting in cars every day, you know, access to good quality food. Like, these are all the sort of pluses in terms of actually tackling the climate crisis. So it's not sort of this perception often that we're going to end up, you know, having to make sort of these sacrifices in our quality of life, in lots of ways our quality of life will improve by tackling the climate crisis.
It is very much that the discussion happens, you know, is framed very much like, what are the sacrifices you have to make and what are all these personal sacrifices? And to me as well, it seems, and looking at it, of course, at its core, you know, there's the whole problem with our consumption model and our model of capitalism, and that, you know, it's built in it is, you know, the idea of, you know, endless continuous growth and economic growth. And this, you know, we know we have the problem with products, with inbuilt obsolescence. And we talk about that, you know, that products which, you know, could be repaired and, you know, could be built for, you know, long lasting life. And, you know, we look at even technology and they talk about, you know, technology being a solution, but of course, technology consumes resources as well. And it does link back to our wider society that, you know, so much of people's, even, you know, their notional sense of well-being is linked to consumption. And that the way we've created these societies and economies that are just so much based, everything is based around consumption, but a consumption that's based on a continued exploitation of resources. And, you know, when you talk about, we have to think about the impacts. I think about like my children and, you know, I have a teenager who talks to me about this and you're going, like, for their future, it's, you know, what planet are we leaving them, you know, for biodiversity? And to me, it is... we're missing a fundamental question around that, which is what type, you know, what are the nature of our economies?
Absolutely. I mean, there's really great research done by Jason Hickel, who kind of points out that this idea that we can have some kind of green growth model, that we can decouple emissions from growth, like, that isn't proving true. So I think we need to really rethink what our response to the climate crisis is. Equally, this whole idea that we can kind of create markets and that markets will be able to kind of lead us out of this is really interesting research done into sort of the effectiveness of market mechanisms to tackle climate change to date. And they've shown, for example, a study of the ETS, which is the EU's emissions trading scheme, a market-based mechanism for tackling climate change. The actual emission reductions achieved from that are fairly modest. They're about up to 1-2% year on year on average. Now, some of that is they were teething problems in the beginning, but this idea that we can kind of keep trying the same solutions and kind of expect to get a different result, to me, I don't find it particularly hopeful. That said, I do find, you know, reading scholarship from, for example, eco-feminist scholars who will talk about, you know, growing our care budget and shrinking our carbon budget, thinking kind of cooperatively, thinking about far more exciting ways of being and living and, you know, learning. That to me is so much more exciting. So I think in terms of how we kind of have this discussion, it's so important that there is, you know, that we appreciate the scale of the challenge and don't kind of underestimate that, but at the same time that the solutions are positively focused, you know, that there is a much better life if we tackle the climate crisis, and how that links completely with tackling the housing crisis, how that definitely links with improved health outcomes. You know, it's those things are intrinsically linked.
Yeah, no, I think that's really, really interesting. And it is something that it does give me hope as well, that there is a way, you know, the point being that the climate crisis has shown us that, you know, our existing models of economy and society don't work. And, you know, they don't work for so many people. And I think in particular that, you know, that ecofeminist perspective is a really important one, that that value of care. And I remember Naomi Klein has done some fantastic, The Intercept, some fantastic short documentaries with Alexandria Ocortez around, you know, looking to the future and that valuing of care. And that way in which, you know, the expansion of, for example, care and care support can be a low carbon or, you know, essentially zero carbon way of expanding our supports while not doing a true consumption. And I think it's really, it shows to me as well that that the climate discussion needs to be part of a discussion about how we change our economic and social models to put care first, to put, you know, equality first. That if it's divorced from those, it's just going to be, as you say, this kind of market model that isn't really going to, you know, address either the climate crisis or those other issues of social justice either.
Yeah, and I think John Barry, who's a fantastic scholar based in Queens, he talks about the idea that the decarbonisation transition is some way inevitable, but what's not inevitable is justice. So, you know, who's going to bear the burden? Who's going to kind of reap the benefits from it? And, you know, I think it's really important as we kind of go forward that that's sort of to the fore of what we're about in tackling the climate crisis. So I suppose that's kind of maybe where I come at it with a human rights based approach, because I think with human rights, there's this sort of idea that they sort of create a baseline below which we won't ever go, you know, that human dignity is so important that, you know, that that's what we center in terms of how we respond to the climate crisis. We don't want people pushed into poverty as a consequence of the crisis. We don't want people displaced from their lands so that we can, I don't know, to set up a massive wind farm on their lands. You know, it has to be cooperative. It has to be, you know, community-based solutions. And those are there. And I think for me, kind of throughout the COVID crisis, something I really started to see and kind of take heart in was how many, you know, how actually people's sort of, how many people do really appreciate nature and having green spaces. And, you know, actually what most people want for is very much sustainable and sort of can be done within the planetary boundaries. So I think that's really important. Also, maybe kind of related, I as much as an environmentalist, I do take sort of small individual steps in terms of trying to eat vegetarian or try to fly much less. I kind of really don't like an overemphasis on personal responsibility in this. These are structural issues, and, you know, accountability belongs at the state level, at the corporate level. It's not on us as individuals to sort of feel really guilty about it and to sort of feel disempowered by the climate sort of crisis. And it can feel very much like that. I think, you know, the only reason really I think that sort of the personal responsibility piece is useful. And I think Mary Robinson made this point really well, as, you know, do one thing in your life, and then, you know, if it's reducing your food waste or cycling, but after that, get angry and look outwards. Because I think if we stop kind of there, it can be really frustrating, it can be really demoralizing. So the responsibility ultimately, you know, I think we do these things to kind of get a sense of what our future could look like, you know, if it's growing our own vegetables, if it's you know, trying to commute in a more sustainable way, but ultimately responsibility lies at the state level and with kind of systems as opposed to kind of individuals. So I think that's really important to kind of underscore.
Yeah, no, I think that's really, it's a really important point, and it's an important perspective, you know, and I try to do what I can as well, you know, and we do as individuals. And I think it's really interesting to hear different ideas about, you know, how we can reduce our emissions. And you know, even it was interesting, the flying, and the, like, I haven't flown probably for 2.5 years, in part because with little children, you don't want to, it's not the most enjoyment of experiences. But even still though, it's I was struck during COVID about that, you know, that the planes coming out of the air, you know, airlines not, you know, flying in the same level, and thinking, you know, when you think of all the disruption that happened during COVID and how things were changed, and you go, you know, like, I think about it in relation to the housing crisis, so you think about it in relation to climate, like what we could do, you know, if we just came together really as a society and said we want to change this. And I think that speaks to what you're saying there, that I feel like what you're saying, the real responsibility on people and the call to people is that, you know, don't try and individualize this, but actually bring it together. And, you know, it is through people speaking up that, you know, we can change this. Because if you look at, you know, the students march, the climate marches, like they absolutely changed the agenda in terms of this, you know, scientists speaking up, you know, Greta Thunberg, others, you know, individuals and collectively speaking up has brought this to a point where, you know, it is clearly a major political issue. There's not enough being done. And maybe just to finish, where would you see that, or what do you think, where is it going, the climate movement? Obviously, you know, COVID completely, you know, reduced the ability of people to collectively march and that. But is there energy again in the run up to November? Are we likely to see strikes, protests? What do you think in Ireland in terms of our climate movement now with the Greens in government? Does that change the dynamic?
I think it's sort of all to play for, to be honest. Like, I would hope that there, you know, with this sort of growing interest, that is on the agenda. I think as sort of what we can do is just to continue to put pressure on our politicians, on our unions, on our you know, across the board, at every organizational level. I think it's really important that, you know, that pressure is sort of fed upwards. I think in terms of what we can expect from COP, I'm hoping that more ambition is going to be forthcoming, particularly at the Irish level. I think it's so important as a kind of historic contributor that we really start to push to actually significantly reduce our emissions. One thing I would love to see, for example, going back to that negative emissions piece, is that we would actually start to be really honest about this and say that we are going to, you know, if we're going to go this route, which is what is implicitly being planned, that we have a very clear budget saying this is how much we're going to rely on negative emissions and this is how much we're actually going to reduce emissions. I think moving the dial away from this sort of net negative emissions technology or net zero targets where we're relying on huge amounts of negative emissions and actually starting to talk about full decarbonizing our societies, recognizing that there will always be some level of emissions coming from things like agriculture, that's sort of inevitable, but that we get as close to zero as possible is so important. And I think in developed countries like Ireland and across the global north, putting pressure on our governments to fully decarbonize, to not push this kind of responsibility onto developing countries is so important. One other thing I would love to kind of see undone quite quickly within the climate bill. So we have a very strange provision that, as me as a sort of a legal background, I was really unimpressed with. It's a provision at the start of the bill which basically says that the government or the state won't be responsible and you can't bring an action in damages against the state if we don't achieve any of our, if we don't kind of fulfill our obligations under this act. That to me was really surprising in terms of that access to justice piece. Individuals, NGOs, we enjoy, based on human rights, a right of access to justice, a right of access to a remedy. And that to me needs to go immediately. And I think it's really disappointing to see how that found its way into to this climate act. It wasn't there before. This idea that we are trying to kind of wriggle our way out of responsibility, you know, it is not, you know, I don't think it's acceptable at this point in the climate crisis. So I think kind of building up that responsibility piece, you know, taking our obligations seriously. And one way I think to show we're doing that will be to get rid of that provision. But yeah, I am hopeful. I hope that, you know, in the next few months, I think there's going to be an increasing emphasis on the just transition and that needs to be led from sort of affected communities, affected workers, and that really needs to be on the agenda from here on out. You know, I think this emphasis on sort of listening and kind of a people-based approach to climate change is so important. And I think we have so much to learn from that just transition movement in terms of how we we tackle the climate crisis.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And I think that you're right in terms of the, you know, people have to be central to this, and, you know, the just transition has to be central as well. Hello, Aisling. How are you? I'm in the middle of a podcast.
It's 11.
I know it's 11 o'clock. Do you want to say hello to Orla?
Hi, Orla.
Hello.
Tell her what's your name.
Hi.
My name's Aisling.
Hi, Aisling. I'm Orla.
I've been on the podcast before.
Do you know what we're talking about?
Wow.
Orla, what are we talking about?
We're talking about climate change. Have you been to the climate strikes?
Climate protests. Remember you did the school once?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, very good. Did you make a poster?
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
and what,
wow.
Do you think the climate change is important?
Yeah.
Why?
I don't know.
Because the planet. Remember we talked about it?
Yeah.
Yeah, the planet.
But that was a long time ago. Now it's 11. Can we go to the library?
Yes, you can go to the library.
But you have to drive us, remember?
I know. I'll be there in 2 seconds.
I'm very impressed.
Give me 2 minutes
that she wants to go to the library.
Pardon?
I'm very impressed she wants to go to the library.
I know.
The future is in good hands, I think.
It is. The public library is a fantastic resource. Orla, it's been fantastic to have you on, and Aisling has told me my time is up. Our time is up. I could talk to you much longer. and it would be great to have you back again in the next while as we run up to COP26, but also in terms of that monitoring and, you know, analysing what we could do in terms of a just transition and what the government is doing.
Absolutely.
It'd be great.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on, Rory. Lovely chatting with you.
Yes, you too, Orla. And we'll remind listeners that you could become a patron. Sign up to patreon.com/tortoiseshack. And thanks a million for listening, and we will talk to you all soon.